I would have you, as the lights come up, look at your Bible and pull out your outline if you will take a moment to do so this morning. And let me just say something that's sort of self-evident. What's with my title? I mean, seriously. I struggled with the words when it came to this title. I did a little focus group, in fact, asking others for their opinion. I have a book on my bookshelf that is, more than any other influence in my life, the reason, a human influence, the reason I'm still in ministry today. It's called Disappointment with God. It was written by Philip Yancey years ago, and I only bring that up to tell you this. No book has he written, and frankly, most authors, you could add them to this category as well, has gotten more negative reaction at the title itself than anything that was said within its pages. Disappointment with God was met with a visceral reaction by many in the Christian community. I suspect partly because it took us into a conversation that was uncomfortable. Are you kidding me? Disappointment with God? That's blasphemous, is it not? And I'm just telling you, and if you're intrigued, I would almost buy the book for you. It was that important and timely in my journey with Jesus Christ when the wheels came off. And if you know somebody like that, or you are somebody like that, you can do a lot worse than read that book. Now, enough said about disappointment with God, because this sermon's not about that at all. It's about my title, actually, Surviving the Silence of God. And I told you I struggled with the words. I actually considered something a little softer. Surviving, this was another possibility. Surviving when God seems silent. Do you see how it softens it? I almost went with that, and then I thought, no, wait a second. That falls short of my reality. There, I'm putting myself way out there. If this is truer to my reality, surviving the silence of God, and if you think I've just got a bad attitude this morning, just take a look at Job in the Bible, which most theologians believe was the very first book written. It doesn't come that way in the chronology of Scripture, but it goes way back. And Job had life fall apart, and then for 37 chapters of a 42-chapter book, silence. Complete, total, systemic silence. So that now you know why I landed on this title. Now, that's kind of the heavy, but that said, one of the things that drives me absolutely nuts is long waits with no explanation. You with me? Okay, so it gets a little lighter from here. You ever stood still in traffic and you dial in the station that has a traffic report every 7 minutes or whatever, and they come to the traffic report and they're telling about how the world's falling apart and all these other places, but not on your freeway. There's no mention of your situation, and meanwhile, you stay stuck. And then if you've got a GPS or a smartphone, you look at that, and the thing that sometimes turns red because you're in a zone that's got a problem, it's not red. It's bright green. And you're thinking, there's no one talking to me. There's no explanation for why I'm sitting here, but I'm not moving. I'm stuck. Years ago, when we first moved to Oregon, we were kind of early and didn't in our 24 years now, almost, of being here, and we didn't really know the lay of the land. We knew that there's great camping. So the Mac 5 loaded up. I sound like the Beverly Hillbillies. We loaded up and headed out. Down south of Newport, went camping, broke camp, and, you know, it's a hard time. You're coming home. You're thinking, well, we'll whiz home, get there, and get things unloaded. So we come up to Lincoln City and decide to head home from Lincoln City to Tigard. And we took Highway 18 and then Highway 99. You know how those connect. And not long after Otis Am I ringing a bell to anybody? Otis is about, you could spit and hit Lincoln City from Otis, right? It's real close. From Otis on, we stopped in bumper to bumper traffic. And it moved an 80-mile drive, I did the math, took us 8 hours. Okay, not quite, but you get the idea, right? We were stuck, right? Nothing's happening, no movement. And it was so much so, and the kids are little, you know, and I'm looking at Debbie, and I'm kind of throwing little messages to her, like, we need to pray, Debbie, and you need to be ready to shield our precious little children's eyes because we're about to go by some dreadful carnage. There's got to be a horrible, and have you done that? You pray for people, you're not sure how many bodies you're going to see. Maybe it's a bus. You're thinking, this is bad. And so she's prepared to kind of, you know, like put a blanket over their heads as we pass by brokenness. Now imagine my surprise, hours into this, to find there's no crash cars. There's no piled up bodies. There's just Dundee. Dundee. A little town that has been a single lane in either direction. The epic, if you want to know a definition of bottleneck, look it up. I did this week. It shows a picture of Dundee. Okay? It has been a single lane while the population of this state swells in size. Dundee has never, ODOT has completely ignored Dundee. Sounds like I live there, don't I? Right? And they've done so since asphalt was invented. Okay? Now, hashtag going nuts in stop traffic without an explanation. That's me. It's the same feeling I have when I'm on an airplane and I'm sitting on the tarmac and you back the big boy up and you're ready to make your way to the rollout and then the taxi and you're set to get home or wherever you're going, right? And then you don't do anything. Engines are revved. You're not doing anything. That dude's not moving. And my eyes, I start looking at landmarks thinking, no, I think we're moving. Nope, we're not moving. That's one problem. But no one says anything. Except Alaska Airlines. They'll tell you every time what's going on. But anyway, no updates kills me. I know. You could correctly say that's a first world problem. But still, it's frustrating to me. The fact is, long waits without explanation will wear you out. Will you write that down? Long waits with no explanation will wear you out. Now, before we journey into a journal written by Asaph, Psalm 77, he wrote Psalm 77, I want to be clear about something that I just said. You and I are living in the longest wait in human history. Do you realize that? It's not a matter of days or hours. It has nothing to do with traffic. It's way longer than a month or years if you're waiting to get married or hoping to conceive. As grueling as those waits are, this wait has lasted for over 2 millennia. That's 20 centuries. I'm referring to the fact that you and I live in the wait for the glorious return of Jesus Christ for his people. 17th century poet Alexander Pope made an observation that I'll bet some of you have quoted to yourself. He's the one that, in three words, kind of summed it up nicely, but not completely. He said, hope springs eternal. It may. But unless I miss my guess, when the wait is long and the silence is deafening, the reason for the wait is unknown. Hope loses, I think, some of that spring he was talking about. More descriptive of the experience of many, I think, who get weary from waiting is a little hidden Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 12. You don't have to turn there, just note it this morning. Hope deferred. That means waiting a long time. That means hoping that it might change. Not only does it not change, but in most cases, nothing's said. Hope deferred. Pretty good description, don't you think? Makes my heart sick. So, let's read this morning a survival guide, Psalm 77. And it's written by Asaph. Probably the thing that I want you to know about him is that he was a member of the temple worship team. He wrote 12 songs, so he's a pretty prolific writer. And Psalm 77 is actually a song. It's one that he wrote, and the Holy Spirit gave him the words. You can supply the tune, okay? But Psalm 77, he begins, well, let me tell you the two things that you're going to see here. He brings into one song pain and then promise. Okay, those two things you're going to see and sense as we kind of look at this together this morning. He begins by describing the difficulty of crying for help when nothing happens. Now, as I start into this and as I start reading, I want you to look for something right from the beginning. I want you to make note of Asaph's vivid words of weariness. And you don't have to search for them. They're in plain view. Let's get started. I cried out to God for help. I cried out to God to hear me. When I was in distress, I sought the Lord. At night, I stretched out untiring hands, and I would not be comforted. I remember you, God, and I groaned. Seems like an oxymoron sentence, does it not? I remembered you, and I want to say, and I felt better all over. I remembered you, and my struggle subsided. He says, I remember you, God, and I groaned. I meditated, and my spirit didn't flourish. It fainted. Verse 4, you kept my eyes from closing. I was too troubled to speak. So he can't sleep. He can't speak. I thought about the former days, the years of long ago. I remember my songs in the night. My heart meditated and my spirit asked. Let me just stop right in mid-sentence here. Let's just make sure we're all getting it. You see in verse 1, he's crying for help. He's crying out saying, God, I just feel like it's bouncing off the ceilings. I don't feel like I'm being, his word, heard. I cried out to God, give me a sense that you hear me. A long wait without explanation. That's what he's saying here. And then distress follows that in verse 2. Distress that knows no comfort. You see, it doesn't resolve in verse 2. I stretch out at night my untiring hands. But there's no comfort in my distress. And then we've touched on groaning, but my groaning, it's so persistent and so chronic that I'm beginning to faint. I'm getting hoarse. I'm faltering. And then trouble shows up in verse 4. That's the word he uses here. I was too troubled beyond words. How many of you have ever lost sleep because you just can't shake it? Whatever it is. Sure, every hand in here goes up. So, long waits without explanation can wear you out. Me too. It's true, isn't it? By the way, weariness isn't just, it seems to me, I was at this point thinking, yeah, long waits are awful. A short wait with a sufficient intensity when the distress is sizable, is nearly unbearable. It's the expression minutes turn into whatever, hours, months. Felt like years. Consider Jesus when you digest what I just said. Arrested late Thursday night, and by 9 o'clock in the morning, that's not, as my watch counts it, it's not that long. It's like an 8-hour shift at work. And some of you are going, yeah, at my job, it feels like that. Okay? But in the big scheme of things, very short time, right? Remember Jesus' words during that time on a cross? Do you remember how he quoted certain words from the Psalms? Because his heart cried out and he drifted back to words he knew well. But notice he did not quote these words. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside quiet waters, and he restores my soul. Oh no, those words were not heard from Jesus on the cross. It was the words in the psalm just before that, in Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? Now that's words of anguish. So far from even hearing me in my cries of anguish. Just like Jesus and Asaph, you're starting to feel like you're in good company, aren't you? We too face times when God seems far from our groanings, causing us to wonder sometimes, do you even see this? Which explains the barrage of questions Asaph asks next. Because when God is silent, questions often stir. Will you write that down? When you're trying to explain some things to somebody that's suffering, and it's been a long wait for them, and they have not heard from God, they start to ask questions. It's a fertile time for questions to pop up. And not just one or two questions, but just look at this list starting in verse 7. I interrupted the flow here. Will the Lord reject forever? There's six in case you're wondering. Will he never show his favor again? Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Has his promise failed for all time? Has God forsaken to be merciful, forgotten to be merciful? Has he in anger withheld his compassion? That's how it rolled in his song. Think of this as a fast-moving bridge in the music. And like most distress-driven questions, certain beliefs are revealed. If you want to look back at those six questions, every one of them is more or less a statement. God, you've rejected me. Is this going to last forever? Does that change the first question? Just look down. Look at it. God, I feel rejected. Is this going to go on forever? God, you stopped showing me your favor. Are you ever going to show it again? You've done this yourself, haven't you? Where you make a statement with a question? Here's a third. Has his unfailing love vanished forever? Because it's sure gone right now. Has his promises failed for all time or just for my life? Wow. Has God forgotten to be merciful? Even though he defines himself in Exodus 34, Numbers 14, Nehemiah 9, Psalm 103, and I could go on and on and on. I am a gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in loving kindness God. But boy, feels like he's forgotten to be merciful. Last question. Has he in anger withheld his compassion? Asaph would say, I see no evidence to suggest otherwise. May I just add two of the most troubling questions you can have in a season like this? How long? And why? I wish I was dumb, God, and couldn't get it, couldn't see, couldn't articulate these things, you might think. The prophet Habakkuk presented both of those questions: how long and why? God responded to him, but I mentioned him already earlier, Job. He too asked the same two questions. How long is this going to go on, God? And may I editorialize? I've been minding my own business, walking with you, doing as you've asked me to do, placing you as the highest priority of my life, and a hurricane not only hits my children, my livelihood, my physical life, there's no sign that it's going to let up. And then God finally speaks in chapter 38, and you know what? Unlike Habakkuk, Job never got answers to his questions, how long and why. Now, I know I'm pushing some of you to the edge, but I want to be honest. That's you see my title, Surviving When God Is Silent. When you're crying for help and you don't feel heard from God, y'all, your struggle is great. And I'm going to say something that I believe. Your spiritual survival is in question. I just let you peek inside my counseling, my study, and my time with people who are near the edge, and they're done. Came across some words that I agree with. I'll say them slowly so you can write this down. God is not really silent. We are deaf. End quote. Teresa of Avila said that. I hesitate saying that name because some of you might reject it on that basis alone. Don't do that. Don't do that. Those are smart words. They may be true, but when our struggle is great and his silence is real, then you know what happens in my life? My struggle just grows in size. And if you told me in that moment, you know, God's not silent, Steve, it's your deaf, and I would go, you know what? I'm not sure I need to have coffee with you again. You know what I mean? So that's what makes the tone change in verse 10 so incredibly conspicuous. Will you look back at the page of this song? Then I thought, those are the words, three words he uses to announce a significant tone change. With these words, Asaph conveys a timeless technique for surviving when God seems silent or when God is silent. Okay. Now, some of you have your pen already clicked and ready to write this down, so I'm going to give you the timeless technique, and then let's just read it together, okay? So here's the timeless technique. Recall what God has done. When the season is long and there's no explanation as to why, how long, then the technique Asaph introduces here is one that says, recall what God has done. Let's watch as he does that, beginning in verse 10. Then I thought, to this I will appeal. The years when the Most High, look at the tense of all that he says here now, stretched out his right hand. I will remember, that's past tense, the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your miracles of long ago. He's recalling what God has done. I will consider all your works and meditate on all your mighty deeds. Your ways, God, are holy. What God is as great as our God? You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the peoples. With your mighty arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, God. The waters saw you and writhed. The very depths were convulsed. The clouds poured down water. The heavens resounded with thunder. Your arrows flashed back and forth. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and quaked. Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters, though your footprints were nowhere to be seen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. He remembered the deeds of the Lord, did he not? That's what he's doing here. Verse 11, I remember the deeds of the Lord. More specific, the very next statement, I remember your miracles. Yeah, I'm going to remember what you did miraculously a long time ago when you did way more than was likely, and get this, logical. You blew our minds. That's what miracles do. If you and I are in the presence of a miracle from God, it classifies as a miracle because it was not likely and incredibly illogical. Swindoll used to say, you know, childbirth is not a miracle. I know it feels that way. You know, the relief of a mother, the astounding, humbling experience for a father, like it was for me. But it's not a miracle, because the outcome is very predictable. Very likely. Very logical. Show me a stressed pregnancy. Show me a pregnancy where the child's not expected to live, or the mother, or both, and it still turns out good. You're getting close to a miracle. Got it? But a miracle is something where 1 + 1 equals something altogether different than 2. And he's remembering these miracles of God, Asaph is. And he thought about God's works, meditated on your mighty deeds and miracles. Notice a couple of things, though, missing from verse 10 to the end. Asaph, this really grabbed my attention. He stopped questioning God. He just came off rapid fire, 6 very scathing questions of God. And they go away altogether. There's only one question he asked later on, verse 13. What God is as great as our God? That's not a question. We call those what? It's a rhetorical question, meaning I'm making a statement. It's not really a question. I'm not asking for your opinion. Well, let's see. Baal, he's pretty close to. No, I'm not asking for that. He's saying, what God is as great as our God? There is no God like our God. The questions completely stop when he calls to mind what God has done. And the second thing that really gets my attention is for the first, 10 or 12 verses, it's all about I and me. Everything's very personal to Asaph. And then he shifts his focus to different pronouns altogether. You and your. Not just a couple, 15 times from verses 13 to 20. He's talking about you, God. Your greatness. Who you are. And it changes everything. When we recall what God has done, things do change. The New Testament understands this. The Apostle Paul said this, when our eyes move to Jesus, since then you have been raised up with Christ, and that's true if you're a believer in Jesus. If you've trusted him and recognize your sinfulness and your inability to have eternal life without Jesus, then you qualify for that first statement. Since then you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of the Father, setting your mind on the things above, not on all this stuff down here that's troubling you. So when our eyes move from us to Him, then the size of our struggle shrinks. That's how it happened for Asaph. And when we remember things like Jesus being the same yesterday, today, and forever, and that Jesus is not only the author but the finisher of our faith, says Hebrews chapter 12, then we start to see what Asaph saw that sustained him. What did he see? Verse 13, he saw stuff that's just so there. It's like served up on a platter. He saw that God is holy and God is, verse 13, great. And he sees that God is this miracle-performing God. See that verse 14? And he's a powerful God. Also in verse 14. And he's a mighty God. And I love this, the word redeemed in verse 15. He's a redeeming God. He doesn't just want to show up. He wants to shore you up. He wants to build you up. He wants to meet you in these difficult times. Little surprised that Asaph then concludes this wonderful song by pointing to the epic miracle in the Bible. Aside from the resurrection of Jesus, there is no miracle that equals it. It's the miracle that is talked about more than any other miracle. You could go to Nehemiah, you could go on to Exodus, you could go a lot of different places and find that it's always on the minds of biblical writers. They point back and they say, wow, God is the God of the Exodus. And that's why verses 15 to the end here is all about that miracle, where God delivered his people from Egyptian slavery and took them into the land of promise. And he did so, verse 19, I can't read it without chuckling. He did so without leaving a whole lot of footprints. He went through the sea. Not over, around, or under. He went through it. Not logical. Not likely. A true miracle of God. Which this miracle, this epic miracle, as I call it, is pointing to this principle. Realize what God can do. Because he did that, he can do it in your life as well. So no wonder it's talked about. No one can imagine the outcome. In a summary way, Isaiah the prophet and Paul the Apostle actually put words to it in 1 Corinthians 2:9. Our eyes have not seen, and our ears have not heard, and our minds cannot conceive, that means imagine, all that God has in store. Will you put your name in that bottom sentence if it's true? That you're one that loves him. That truth is still true, by the way. No matter how weary you are from waiting to hear from God, and some of you are, I know you share your stories. I pray for your stories. And many of us do. Realize what God can do. No matter how distressing your questions are. Some of my most profound moments with people searching for God when their situation is unbearable and the silence is just as bad. We have some of the most special moments as we realize what God can do, even though the distressing questions are like, ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Everywhere you look, doesn't look good. No matter how much of your focus is on you and on your struggle, when you fix your eyes on Jesus, as we were told to do so in Hebrews 12, Colossians 3, the Jesus that's the same yesterday, today, and forever, then everything changes. Just as it did for Asaph. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. And as you do, and the worship team's going to come sing a final song like we do week after week. I don't mean to make that sound like it's just sort of a icing on a cake, because I think it's really done for a strategic purpose. It's a moment for you to take a look at what seems unbearable in your life. And if you don't have something big enough, think about someone you love and what they're faced with in their lives. And it's made more difficult to manage because God seems silent. No, God is silent. For reasons that this sermon didn't even attempt to address, God is allowing that person you love, or you, to be in a season of silence from Him. Which may, in fact, be the ultimate setup for you to see clearly His move when He makes it. I'll be quiet for a moment to give you a moment to say, Jesus, I really do need your help. I've come to this place in my life where my spiritual survival in this season is in question. I'm weary to the point of giving up. But God, I've heard from you this morning through your son Jesus, through Job, through Asaph. And I guess I'm going to believe that you are saying these things for my sake, for the sake of that one I'm praying for right now. I'm recalling what you can do, what you have done, and now I'm asking you to do in my life. Make a move, God, please, that's God's size, that's so big and so bold that no one anywhere gets the credit except you. There's not a single person that has ever given or attempted to give a human being the credit for the Exodus, Lord. It was all you. That's the kind of move I want you to make in the lives of people I'm thinking of right now. As ushers come to pick up the morning offering and collect your gifts, and also pick up your prayer request, will you put that situation that you need a miracle, you need God to move, will you put that down there by as an act of faith in your life or the life of someone you love? Will you do that this morning? And if you don't have time right now, that's okay. Call it in, because we want to pray all over that this week. In Jesus' name.